Welcome to this week's edition of Liberation Radio, podcast of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Each week we bring you interviews and analysis on the struggles affecting poor and working people throughout the U.S. and the world, building the movement for socialism in the United States. I'm your host, Sean Garcia.
We are here on Liberation Radio with Gloria LaRiva, who is the Party for Socialism and Liberation's 2016 candidate for president, and who just recently returned from an educational tour of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea. Gloria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And so I want to just jump right into the interview. And I know that you also were in the DPRK / North Korea in 1989. So having been back just a few decades later, what were some of the things that actually stood out the most to you about the country itself and the changes that it's gone through?
The two times that I went to North Korea were very important because 1989 was a time when the socialist camp of Eastern Europe was becoming undone, and Soviet Union was soon to be, demise in 1991. But before that time, the Soviet Union began to demand hard currency trade with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So the economic pressure was enormous. And Korea in the next 20 years underwent something very similar to what Cuba experienced. Cuba called it the special period of the 90s and the early 2000s, in which 80% of its trade was gone overnight with the Soviet Union and had to undergo a very, very severe time. Well, the Democratic People's Republic, the DPRK of North Korea, underwent the same thing, but much more severe. And they call that time of the 90s and the early 2000s, they call it the Arduous March, in which they had to sacrifice a great deal because they lost their trade with the Soviet Union, with Russia, and was affected also their trade with China. Then in 1994-95, they experienced the most severe flood, unprecedented flood. For example, just to give you an example, in North Hwanghae province of North Korea, in 7 hours alone in August of 1995, 34.5 inches of rain fell. That's a deluge that I have never heard of to that extent. So all of North Korea's agriculture was wiped away. And what ensued was, very tragically, a famine. Several hundred thousand people died. The estimates are not quite clear, but certainly they it was a very, very hard time for them. And now, going back to the DPRK this October, was a dramatic change because their agriculture has recovered, although, it's still not to the level that they wish. And it was harvest time when we were there, so we saw everybody in the fields, the farmers, the peasants, the people in the countryside, collecting all the rice, the cabbage, everything that was being harvested. But we also saw an enormous 1.4 square meter agricultural plant, which was all a massive 1.4 million square meter greenhouse and hydroponic plant, which provides much of the vegetables for Pyongyang, the capital. And it's quite remarkable because it has been built since the time of the 1990s. What I saw with our 10-person delegation that was sponsored by Global Tours was very impressive development, not only agricultural, but in Pyongyang, which, by the way, is only 62 years old because it was obliterated along with the rest of the country by the U.S. United Nations bombing in 1953, from 1950 to 1953. And not only did I see in Pyongyang 1989 a lot of skyscrapers of housing for the people, but this time we were taken down one main street where five-story housing buildings were torn down, and in 2012, a whole series of huge, beautiful, modern skyscrapers of housing, you know, dozens of floors high, and it's all free housing for the people. So it was very heartening to see the progress. The trolleys, the buses, the subway system, they're all working constantly, people filling the buses. At nighttime, the buildings were lit up. People have lighting, and that's in contrast to the 1990s and 2000s when there were years of literally no heat in the wintertime. And North Korea's weather is very equivalent to what takes place in Canada during the wintertime. So they have come out of a long, difficult period. We were very glad to see the progress.
Mm-hmm. And North Korea is also a country that's under a number of sanctions. And did you see or get any sense of what the impact has been or continues to be of sanctions on North Korea?
The people constantly talk about the effect of sanctions, but you can still see it in the countryside. Almost all the labor and the harvesting that we saw was done by hand. There still isn't the ability to obtain the tractors that are needed for harvesting. They still have to rely solely on manual labor. We saw very, very few tractors because it is so costly. And yet, I think that Korea's economic policy of the last 15 years has helped it greatly. They have now, for example, a number of factories from South Korea that are operating on the border inside of the DPRK, and there are tens of thousands of workers working there that's providing employment. They also have engaged in some economic changes like Cuba did to allow some self-employment, some limited small enterprises that are run by people as cooperatives. There are both non-agricultural and agricultural cooperatives that we were told about. This has helped alleviate the effect of the sanctions. But the most telling and the highlight of the trip was the 70th anniversary of the Workers' Party of Korea and a great military parade that took place while we were there. The parade was meant to show the military strength, the Songun policy, as they call it, meaning military first, of assuring North Korea that they are highly organized, defended in case of any U.S. or South Korean or Japanese aggression. Because the war of 1950-53, the so-called Korean War, is not over. It's simply an armistice. The U.S. and South Korea and Japan engage in continual annual military exercises that are a virtual run-through on bombing North Korea. Korea lost 4 million people in the Korean War. So although in the United States, the media demonizes the country through its leader Kim Jong-un and previous leaders Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, it is simply meant to make the Korean people invisible and justify whatever aggressions, sanctions, attacks on North Korea that the U.S. wishes. That's why our trip and delegation, along with thousands of other tourists that were there, is so important. And I would highly recommend for people to consider taking the global tourist trip, because it's only by seeing it ourselves that we can really look through this smokescreen of U.S. propaganda against Korea. What we found was a highly collective, cooperative society. You can see the children in the street playing at dusk, you know, little kids, no fear of being kidnapped or violence. It's a very, very peaceful society, and it was a great honor to be there.
Mm-hmm. And if there was one thing in terms of myths you think people have here in America about the DPRK that was sort of misspelled by going on the tour, what would that one thing be that you would want people to know?
The one singular impression that you see throughout the country is of a dignified, peaceful, and happy people. On a Sunday, for example, in Pyongyang, we went through in a very extensive park that includes an amusement park with all kinds of rides, a roller coaster, and all kinds of scary rides that we have here. And you see gatherings of hundreds of people watching dancing. And what people do is they turn on sound boxes and just dance spontaneously in the street because it's a very loved form of exercise and entertainment. Then we were through the amusement park and just children laughing, screaming on the roller coaster. We met with a group of young girls, 13-year-olds, and asked them, oh, can you show us your dancing? No shyness at all. And when we went to the restaurants, waitresses, the workers, they're very used to when they have special guests singing for them. People love to sing. They love to dance. It's a highly cultured society, high education, which is free, healthcare, which is free, and as I said, housing, which is amazing condition and all free. Now, some people in the U.S., you know, I've talked to people, said I was in North Korea, say it was really beautiful. Here's some pictures, and they go, well, that's all that you got to see. You know, you can't hide certain things. You see no homeless people in Korea. You see no hunger in the street. You don't see violence in the street or police running through with raids or gunning someone down. It requires of the people of the United States to become much more familiar with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and to see through the propaganda that we're fed every day to understand that Korea is not the threat. The U.S. government is the threat to the Korean people and why they need to keep up their defense, why with all their progress and development that they want to keep that peace. Just this very week, there was another exchange and encounter of probably some 300 South and North Korean people, really in their 80s and 90s, who were separated during the Korean War and never got to see their loved ones, mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, sisters, brothers, and to see the images of these families finally meeting, which is only a handful, literally, of the 10 million Korean people who were separated for all these 70 years, so tragically, and the suffering that still exists. The yearning in the North is very evident to us. People talked about it. When we told them we were for the reunification of Korea, people were very emotional, very, very appreciative of our solidarity. It's a tremendous yearning and something which shows, you know, North Korea has only 15% arable land. The rest is high mountains. It's a very strong mountain range throughout the country. And South Korea has great expanses of land. The North has a great industrial capacity. They were much further advanced industrially in the 60s and 70s than the South Korea. So the two countries, which is really one country, must be united once again. The obstacle is United States military occupation of the South. That's why we see so much demonization of North Korea, because the U.S. has to constantly justify its military occupation, its repression in the South, and its threat against the North, and to remember that the Korean War is not over, and the main demand of the American people must be to demand that the U.S. occupation end immediately and allow the country to become one again.
Well, thank you so much for your impressions. And once again, on Liberation Radio, we were joined by Gloria LaRiva, the 2016 presidential candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who just returned from an educational tour in North Korea, also known as, or officially known as, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Gloria, thank you so much for joining us. We're here on Liberation Radio. I'm Eugene Puryear, and we are talking to Richard Becker, an organizer with the Answer Coalition and also the author of Israel, Palestine, and U.S. Empire. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on.
And we want to get into the escalation of the situation that's going on inside of Palestine. And just for our listeners who may not fully have been following or understanding what's going on, can you just sort of frame this recent flare-up in tensions in the occupied territories?
Well, I think that we have to see it in the context of the reality on the ground that exists in Palestine and for the Palestinian people in particular. And those conditions are really a form of apartheid. And you mentioned the book that we wrote, and I want to just quote something from 2008, an article that was written by Mondli Makanya. And he was an anti-apartheid fighter in South Africa. South Africa probably has one of the strongest Palestine solidarity movements in the entire world, if not the strongest one. And he traveled to Palestine, and he wrote this. "When you observe from afar, you know that things are bad, but you do not know how bad. Nothing can prepare you for the evil we have seen here. It is worse, worse, worse than everything we endured. The level of apartheid, the racism, and the brutality are worse than the worst period of apartheid. The apartheid regime viewed black people as inferior. I do not think that the Israelis see the Palestinians as human beings at all. How can a human brain engineer this total separation, the separate roads, the checkpoints? What we went through was terrible, 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 and yet there's no comparison. Here it is even more terrible." And I think what's really something about that is the world knew about apartheid in South Africa, but doesn't, I think, fully understand yet, or maybe a lot of the world does, but less understood in the United States, that every single day people are being shot down with live ammunition or with rubber bullets, which aren't really rubber bullets at all. They're steel bullets that have a plastic coating but do great damage. Houses are demolished, Palestinians' houses. Olive trees are uprooted. Just this week, 140 more olive trees are going to be uprooted in the northern part of the West Bank to create yet another so-called nature reserve. This is a trick by the Israeli occupation authorities to provide more land for expansion of settlements and to deprive the Palestinians, 80,000 of whom depend on the olive oil industry for a living, of a way to live. And so the constant pressure, there's more than 6,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons. There are, of course, no Israelis in Palestinian prisons, which I think brings out the oppressed and oppressor relationship that goes on there. So this has gone on, and now there has been really a new upsurge. Some people are asking, is this the third intifada? It may not be that yet, but a huge upsurge of both protests all over the West Bank and in Gaza and inside the mainly Palestinian areas of the 1948 borders of Israel, and what are clearly spontaneous attacks, often knife attacks, stabbing attacks by very young people, Palestinians, against settlers, particularly in East Jerusalem, which along with the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights has really illegally been seized by Israel and incorporated into the Israeli state. So in short, what we have is enormous level of frustration because of the enormous level of oppression and repression that the Palestinian people suffer. And this, of course, eventually brings rebellion. In Palestine, the rebellion has been constant. It's been a constant struggle to be able to stay, to resist what the Israelis are trying to do, which is to push the Palestinian people out and to fight for liberation and for the right to self-determination and their homeland.
And just briefly to dig a touch deeper into that, the way the Western media is really depicting this is as if it's a group of sort of crazed Palestinians running around attacking Israelis, and as if there's almost no Palestinian casualties, or if the Israeli military and police is acting in a way that is completely consistent with humanitarian aims. And you spoke to this a little bit, but I just wondered if you could reflect a little bit more on this mainstream media narrative here in the West.
Yeah, that's a very important point. And that mainstream media narrative would have us believe that it's again an example of Palestinian aggression or Palestinian terrorism, as they always like to call it. And we never get that from the other side, that it's the Israeli terrorism that goes on constantly, both the official terrorism at the hands of the Israeli occupation forces, which they should be called, not defense forces, and at the hands of armed settlers. All the settlers are issued weapons, automatic weapons, and they feel free to use them, and they're protected when they do use them against the Palestinians by the Israeli occupation forces. So just to give one statistic, since October 1st, 7 Israelis are reported killed and 70 injured. In that same period of time, 32 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,300 have been injured or wounded by the settlers, or most of them by the occupation forces. And you know, one other thing that I think shows that drawing an equal sign, which we don't even get that here, but some draw an equal sign between the Palestinians on the one side and the Israelis on the other. But there are no, as I said, there are no Israelis in Palestinian jails. And when acts of what the Israeli state calls terrorism are carried out, acts of resistance are carried out, the homes of the persons, if they can be identified, are then demolished within 2 weeks, and the whole family is left homeless. When there are acts that even the state of Israel admits are terrorist attacks by the Israelis, that practice has never been used in the entire history of the colonial state of Israel.
And President of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, recently made significant headlines when he spoke at the United Nations and was highly critical of the Israeli state violating the Oslo Accords. What significance do you attach, if any, to President Abbas's appearance before the United Nations, and does it have any connection to the current uprising going on in Palestine?
Well, I think that what Mahmoud Abbas said at the United Nations was a reflection of the view, and he's trying to retain some base of popular support, of the vast majority of people. The Oslo Accords were signed back in 1993. The expectation was that it would lead to the creation of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. That has never happened. Gaza remains occupied from outside, and sometimes, you know, with frequent bombings inside by the Israelis. The West Bank remains occupied. East Jerusalem remains occupied. So there's no credibility in the minds of the Palestinian people anymore for the Oslo Agreement. And whether and it may be that that statement has also contributed to the sentiments, the already boiling sentiments of the Palestinian people, because of the conditions of occupation. At the same time, we have to say that according to reports, the Palestinian Authority police are continuing cooperation with Israeli security forces. To the extent that that is actually still taking place, we cannot verify, but to the degree that it is, it harms the Palestinian liberation cause.
And we are entering the 2016 campaign season here in the United States. Now, of course, the Republican Party has been vociferously in support of the Israeli government, but there was almost no mention in the Democratic Party's first debate of Israel-Palestine issues. Can we expect on the Democratic side for there to be any emergence of a more balanced position or pro-Palestinian position from any of the candidates?
Well, I think it's doubtful from either of the two capitalist imperialist parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, and both support the empire. Israel continues to play a very important role strategically for the United States. And if we look at the broader situation in the Middle East with the crises in Syria and Iraq and Libya, Yemen, Afghanistan, which isn't really the Middle East, but connected to this, we can see that given the fact that the United States has really, to a large degree, lost its role as the regulator of affairs, that the Israeli military, which from the Pentagon's point of view is seen as an extension of U.S. military power, that Israel retains a critical role in the U.S. imperialist system. So it is unlikely that we will hear much from any of the Democrats that will be in any way more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause.
And once again here on Liberation Radio, we were joined by Richard Becker, who is the author of the book Israel, Palestine, and U.S. Empire that is available on Amazon.com. Mr. Becker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Eugene.